What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Clinton and Trump take New York, Obama abroad, criminal charges in Flint, and music legend Prince dead at 57. Big wins in the New York primary Tuesday brought Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump closer to their party's nominations.
The race for the Democratic nomination is in the home stretch, and victory is in sight.
Senator Cruz is just about mathematically eliminated.
President Obama lunching with the Queen in London on the day after her birthday. Between stops in Saudi Arabia and Germany, here's NBC's Keir Simmons on the president's London visit.
He'll lunch with the Queen, who's met 11 U.S. leaders. And she's still here, now entering her 10th decade.
And pop superstar Prince has died at 57. Here's his most iconic song, 1984's Purple Rain. This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kara Lee of The Wall Street Journal, Olivia Knox of Yahoo News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you thinking about Trump versus Clinton in the fall? How's Obama look abroad? What are you thinking on Harriet Tubman on Prince? Joining me now from Washington is Kara Lee, White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Kara Lee, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Olivier Knox, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Olivier, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Carol, and Olivier.
Can we just go first? We'll dive right into politics and Harriet Tubman and Saudis and Britons and Brexit and all the rest. But at the UN today, 160 world leaders, national leaders there, signing on to the Paris Climate Change Accord. And at the same time, this is to try and keep the ultimate warming of the planet under 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 2 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial levels. But I'm reading here today, temperature has risen half that much already. The climate appears to be destabilizing. Great ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are already starting to melt. Kara Lee, it's Earth Day. As this big signing takes place, after all that drama and the tone of progress in Paris, how far toward where we need to get does this agreement appear to get us if people follow it?
Well, that's the big question, whether or not people follow through. This is obviously a symbolic move, and it, you know, from the White House's perspective, it means that one of the president's major foreign policy initiatives is moving forward. But, you know, it's not going to be known for some time whether or not these countries, it's a lot of countries, 167, mm-hmm. Whether they actually follow through with what they've agreed to do. And, you know, as you mentioned, there are significant problems if that doesn't happen. And so, you know, this is a President Obama doesn't have that much time left in office to keep this on track. So a lot of this will be left to his successors.
Olivier, the Supreme Court ruled against Obama's power plans or for power generation and left states open to challenge that and maybe go their own way. What about the U.S. part of this? Does the U.S. have its commitment under Paris wrapped up on the rails?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, because one of the most important aspects of this deal was that the United States and China, which together account for about 40% of carbon emissions blamed mm-hmm. for global warming, both countries agreed to get their emissions, I don't want to say under control, but to lower them. So the United States will cut somewhere between 26 and 28% from 2005 levels by 2025. On some level, the bilateral part of this is more interesting. Can China and the United States do this? Because as the global leaders in emissions, can they convince developing countries to make the kinds of trade-offs that are necessary to roll this stuff back?
Jack, 30 more seconds for the future of the planet itself on Earth Day before we dive into politics. I mean, it is ironic. You know, we pay so much attention to the back and forths and all the rhetoric and everything that's said and done. And here we've got ice shelves reportedly, you know, sort of readying to plop into the sea, and who knows what consequences.
Yes, and that's sort of a symbol of how precarious this whole process is for the United States, challenging the courts, as you say, and really on the ballot in the fall. Donald Trump has tweeted that climate change is something that China ginned up to create confusion in the world and allow its industrialization to proceed. And Ted Cruz, of course, is a committed climate science denier. If either man wins, then such as it is, our progress, our connection with this Paris Accord, with this now UN Accord, will stop.
We talk a lot about climate change on this show, and we'll come back to it. But as you just suggest right there, the outcome of the election will have consequences when it comes to how that's addressed or not addressed or even understood. Olivier, take us into what happened this week on the political front. Do we have solid front runners? Do we have essentially the nominees in front of us, or is it still more wobbly and weird than that this year?
Well, 2016 is definitely wobbly and weird. I'll sign on to that.
Okay.
What we have is we have Hillary Clinton widening her lead. It is possible. I could take a quarter out of my pocket, flip it 10 times, and get 10 tails. That's mathematically possible. It's just not likely. At this point, you've got to look at Bernie Sanders' chances that way. He's run a shockingly strong campaign, but I think that Hillary's convincing win in New York makes it it makes his hill even steeper. Now, on the Republican side, that's really where the interesting stuff is going on. Donald Trump is definitely the front runner. He remains the front runner. He has a difficult but plausible path to having the 1,237 delegates that he needs to clinch the nomination before the convention. Ted Cruz is now openly talking about his odds at a contested convention. So that's the Republican side. It's definitely more interesting. But as you point out, we still have two strong front runners. Hillary's a stronger front runner compared to Bernie Sanders than is much stronger on her side than Trump is on his. But New York kind of confirmed some of our earlier prejudices.
And five more big ones in the Northeast coming up right in front of us on Tuesday. Here's Donald Trump yesterday on NBC's Today Show defending his hot rhetoric in the campaign, but also promising that he will very soon change his campaigning persona.
It's easier for me to be presidential than for me to be doing what I've been doing for the last really 9 months. But at the right time, I will be so presidential, you will be so bored.
You'll be so presidential, you'll be so bored. Carol Lee, can he make the turn to break through that ceiling everybody talks about with Donald Trump to bring in more Republican supporters where he's hit that kind of ceiling, though New York is not that low a ceiling, and for that matter, reach out to independents and beyond if he becomes Donald Trump presidential guy?
Well, he's certainly trying, and if his approach so far continues to work, and by that I mean doing everything that conventional wisdom would say not to do. I mean, if you listen to what he just said, he basically admitted to being a shapeshifter, which is something voters typically really dislike. But he's putting it out there and saying, hey, I'm going to be this new person, and I've been acting this whole time.
But his new campaign chief, Paul Manafort, basically saying the same thing, that this sort of incendiary style is more or less an act.
Well, right, that he's performing, and that was his pitch to Republicans.
But then maybe all politicians perform at some level, or maybe not. Bernie Sanders supporters may call in and say, no, that's the real deal.
Yeah, well, they all do perform at some level, but most of them, in fact, probably all of them, don't admit it. And that's the difference
with
Donald Trump. Yeah. Right. And he's just putting it out there, which is how he's run his campaign, and so far that's been successful for him. I think that people generally, if you're looking at independents and, you know, perhaps some Democrats in a general election, they would seem to be more likely to move over to a Donald Trump, who is a little bit more of kind of unpredictable, or perhaps would move closer to their positions. For instance, if you look at what he said about transgenders using bathrooms, that's certainly not something that's riling up the Republican base in a way that a Republican candidate would want to.
I've got that tape right here. Again, a town hall with NBC's Today Show. This was just yesterday morning. Came out against North Carolina's controversial bathroom law, Donald Trump did, which says that transgender people have to go to the bathroom that matches the gender on their birth certificate. Trump said if Caitlyn Jenner were to walk into Trump Tower, she could use whichever bathroom she wanted.
You leave it the way it is. There have been very few complaints the way it is. People go, they use the bathroom that they feel is appropriate. There has been so little trouble. And the problem with what happened in North Carolina is the strife and the economic punishment that they're taking.
What? Anybody do whatever? What? Ted Cruz went ballistic.
Have we gone stark raving nuts? This is The political correctness. This is basic common sense. I'm the father of two little girls. Here is basic common sense. Grown adult men, strangers, should not be alone in a bathroom with little girls.
Olivia Knox, here's a real-time kind of test of where people stand, where the real weight of Republicans now stands. Donald Trump with a more libertarian view on this. Live and let live. Ted Cruz, you know, have we gone nuts?
You know, I might get in trouble with my home office for plugging a competitor, but the Daily Beast had a fantastic headline on their version of this story, which was Cruz says Donald Trump is a water closet liberal, which I thought was just really, really, really was very, very strong.
Whatever.
Strong headline game from the Daily Beast. Yeah, yeah, you know, Ted Cruz throughout the campaign has not hesitated to make political hay from some of these culture war moments. You know, he did the same thing after Antonin Scalia died and left that vacancy on the Supreme Court. He's not hesitated to do that.
How'd that work out on New York values this week? Not so great.
Yeah, I mean, the New York values, you know, this is a tough one. I don't know that you can look at Donald Trump's performance in New York and think that it's a bellwether for the rest of the campaign. You know, it was his backyard. He's extremely well known. His kind of persona plays extremely well in New York, although it should be noted, not on Manhattan, which has got to make him boil.
Jack, I want to grab you for just a minute. Forgive me, Olivia. We got the break coming right up. Just speak to this bathroom controversy and where the Trump Cruz chasm here, and what that means for American culture, Republican culture wars.
Yeah, well, it's back in that culture war frame, isn't it?
But within the party now.
Yeah, right. Within the party. I mean, this is Ted Cruz being Ted Cruz, which is he's a purist. He's a 100%er. And this is why when you look at the polls in the states that are going to be voting next week, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Connecticut, and the others, he doesn't have a prayer. He is toxic in blue and even purple states. And Trump is going to have a good week next week, partly because of this eclectic profile that he has of, you know, conservative here or libertarian there.
Hold it right there, Jack. We've got to take a short break. Olivier Knox with Yahoo News, Carol Lee with The Wall Street Journal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour with Carol Lee, White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Olivier Knox, Chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Our own Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. A lot going on this week. Trump and Clinton out front, Obama abroad, global warming at the UN, criminal charges in Flint, Michigan. We got Harriet Tubman coming to the $20 bill. Prince is dead at 57. Incredible. Are we saving the planet this Earth Day? Are we closing in on the nominees for president? Are they standing right in front of us, the Donald and Hillary? Is it time for Bernie to dial back or forge on? What about Cruz and Kasich? And with Obama abroad in his last year, how do you see his imprint on the world? Should Britons listen to President Obama and stay in the EU? Is he right to play it cool with the Saudis? We've got a lot to look at here. We talked about the Republicans a bit. Hillary Clinton at a town hall in Hartford, Connecticut yesterday, on stage with family members of Sandy Hook victims, said that as president, she would try to change the gun culture in America. Tall order. Here she was.
There has been a concerted effort to try to undermine the real life experiences of people who speak out. Blame the victim, blame the victim's mother, blame the victim's family, blame the victim's neighborhood. Find somebody to blame instead of saying, you know what, we just have too many guns in this country.
Well, Jack, what do you think? Is she picking that because Bernie's record on gun control is not the same as hers? Or is that really a place that's a vote winner for Hillary Clinton? Or is that just the heart?
I think it's the heart, but it's also a vote winner. It's in Connecticut, The state was traumatized, as the nation was, by that horror at Sandy Hook. And, Hillary Clinton has to demonstrate that at some level she's a conviction politician, that she just doesn't adapt as public opinion changes and she sort of catches up with it. And that has been the pattern, you know, on gay marriage, on the Keystone Pipeline, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, whatever it is, she's caught up with public opinion, it seems. She's got to find something that's really, you know, this is my conviction and I'm standing on it. And she did have a slightly different position on guns in 2008. Nevertheless, this is a tough position. And I think it helps her in the credibility sweepstakes. Mm-hmm. It makes her seem grounded and willing to come out for something that is deeply unpopular, not with Democrats necessarily, but with a large swath of the country.
Let me begin to bring in our callers. Naomi in Moncton, Vermont. Naomi, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that in terms of the race between Clinton and Sanders,
yes,
that there seems to be a lot of mischaracterization. One is that one thing is that Obama in 2008 actually didn't do as well as Sanders did in New York, and it took until June of 2008 for Obama to eclipse Clinton's delegate count.
So you're hanging in. You still see the way, even though Olivier Knox says, yeah, you know, it's like getting 10, flipping the coin and getting tails, heads, tails 10 times in a row.
Yeah, and I think that the media really is pretty irresponsible in how they're characterizing.
Well, I hear you, Naomi, and I have to say these voting irregularities in New York really bothered me watching them. I mean, you don't even mention that here, but that really bothered me. On the other hand, you know, numbers are numbers, and I don't think 2008 is exactly like 2016, but let us pick it up. I mean, maybe that whole gamut. I mean, Bernie Sanders, back in Vermont on Tuesday night, talked to reporters about the problems voters faced in New York State.
While I congratulate Secretary Clinton, I must say that I am really concerned about the conduct of the voting process in New York State. And I hope that process will change in the future.
Olivier, speak to this. Naomi says, wait a minute, don't mischaracterize. Bernie could be in there. Obama was in there. Bernie can still do it. But also, what happened in New York? How could you have such an important primary, and now there's an investigation going on, and you've got lots of votes or voters who weren't able to vote? Take on that whole basket, Olivier.
Thanks, Tom.
Sure, anytime.
So there's a lot to unpack in my fellow Vermonters' points. The media being irresponsible because we are pointing to the delegate math and pointing out that the road has narrowed considerably for Bernie Sanders. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is. I mean, it's a difficult, steep climb he has to make. I don't think that's irresponsible. I'm also not saying he should get out of the race.
Yep.
He has clearly earned the right to stay in as long as he wants. And I think actually one of the most important political stories of 2016 is Bernie Sanders' fundraising, where he's been able to match. Oh yeah, he's pulled in an enormous haul, but it's the way that he's done it that's really important. Because when you get a lot of $27 or $29 donations, those people can give to you again and again and again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to top out, and that means that he has enough campaign fuel, in effect, to stay in this as long as he wants. You know, in terms of the voting process, I mean it. It's hard to recognize the voting process you're taught in political science or civics class or what have you in what we do as a country to elect the president.
Yeah, but what about these oops things, which seem pretty darn bad in Brooklyn with all those people who just weren't on the rolls? What's up with that?
Well, that's what this investigation is going to turn up, yeah, right? I mean, we're going to see exactly what the problems were. I mean, I have anecdotal evidence of people, you know, friends of mine and colleagues up in New York running into this exact problem. So we're gonna find out a lot more about that. I think we had some other problems in Arizona. But you know, as you run a state by state election with very few federal standards, if any, you can run into these kinds of problems. I mean, I'm old enough to remember covering the 2000 campaign, which was maybe the it's not a shining example, whatever the opposite of a shining example is.
Yeah.
Of the way you
Hanging
know American elections.
Time. Mm.
Yeah, right. Exactly. The butterfly ballots in Florida. There's the colossal disaster in Florida. You know, we don't do a very good job. I'm hearing a lot of Democratic Party insiders who are wondering about the merits of, you know, even doing a caucus versus a primary.
So much talk about that this week. But at least people ought to be confident that when you go to a vote, I mean, you can arrange the rules any way you want. But in New York, it's a vote and the vote ought to work right. We've got the campaign manager for Bernie Sanders, Jeff Weaver, telling MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show this week that this thing's going to go all the way to the nomination, to the convention, and suggesting that the Sanders campaign will try to flip superdelegates currently pledged to Clinton. Here he is.
We're going to go to the convention. It is extremely unlikely that either candidate will have the requisite number of pledged delegates to get to this number. right? So it is going to be an election determined by the superdelegates.
We hear a lot about 1237 on the GOP side. On the Democrat side is 2,383, and many more of those are superdelegates. Could you see something going on here, Carol Lee, on the floor of the Democratic Convention, which is something like contested or at least a contest for flipping superdelegates?
The idea that Bernie Sanders is going to flip superdelegates just seems a little far-fetched. Hillary Clinton, is strong. I guess you could envision a scenario in which, you know, Bernie Sanders and his supporters at a convention, you know, make some sort of scene or put up some sort of fight. I think it's, you know, the math is such that Hillary Clinton is on track to win the nomination. I think one of the things that'll be interesting to watch as this unfolds and however long this goes on is what this White House does and how they play that. I mean, you've seen the president sit on the sidelines, although Joe Biden continues to nip at the race in ways that the Clinton campaign finds unhelpful, including telling the New York Times this week that a Democrat never won by saying we can't do something and that Democrats need to think big, which the Bernie Sanders campaign sent out in a press release.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Joe.
Yeah. Once again,
thanks, Joe.
This is not the first time, and there's a lot of tension there.
But that's sort of Jack Beatty's point that those statements of principle are important. You need to stand on some.
They are, and I think as Olivia was saying, that Bernie Sanders has earned his right, and he clearly has the right to stay in the race, and he will. You know, he's influenced the debate tremendously, and he will. You know, have a role in the party platform. To go back to the president's role, you know, he has described himself as being the party unifier. And with Donald Trump sort of shifting into changing his tone, and as we all mentioned, it remains to be seen whether that will be sustained, mm-hmm. but that's the goal. You know, he's moving into more of a general election posture, and it's going to require the Democratic Party to be united sooner rather than later. So I think one of the things to watch is how the White House approaches this as this continues to drag on.
We've got a lot to go here, too, but just a couple more from our listeners on politics. Aaron in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, you're on, Aaron. What do you think?
Well, hello, Tom and guests. Thank you for taking the call. I would just like to quote the movie Galaxy Quest and say, Bernie, never give up. Never surrender. His campaign here is, in my opinion, yep. the epitome of the new political paradigm. This blatantly outstated public revolution in politics mm-hmm. is a real thing. It needs to go the distance.
It's real. There's no question about that. And there's Never Give Up, Never Surrender from the Galaxy Quest, scripture for politicians for Bernie Sanders in 2016. Aaron, I appreciate your call. One more right here. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have to disagree with the sentiment that this primary season has somehow been unfair or undemocratic. You know, I know it's tough for Sanders and Cruz supporters to see their candidates trailing behind, but that doesn't mean it's undemocratic. I personally like Clinton, and I really fear a Trump presidency, but in both cases, I think it's disingenuous to attribute their leads to anything more than the simple fact that more people have voted for them. You know, in Hillary's case, more than 10 million people have voted for her. Thank you.
There's going to be plenty of talk about the process as we go forward here. Plenty, and maybe some reconsideration on the other side, maybe even en route. We've got to take it abroad. The president in Saudi Arabia, talking with Gulf leaders there, talking with the Saudi monarchy. That must not have been so easy. And then, of course, today in London, lunch with the Queen, who just turned 90 yesterday. Here they are. It's kind of hard to hear, but this morning, gathering for a photo at Windsor Castle.
Thank you so much.
Very happy.
Thank you.
Guys.
It's wonderful to see you.
So nice to see you.
It's good to see you. Very, very well.
Now, this room is full of mirrors. Where do you want?
Where would you like us?
Just by the fireplace behind Your Majesty. Thank you.
A little royal chit-chat there with the president just sliding into London. We'll look at all that. Carol Lee, think with us for a second about the president's pretty big trip this year. This week. Here we are in the last year of his presidency. He's gone off to the Middle East. Not getting along real well with the Saudis there. Now he's in London saying, please don't leave the EU to the British to the British people. Next to Germany, they've got their hands full with EU solidarity and refugee problems and so much more. Does this look like a patch-up tour, or is he affirming a new world that Obama hath wrought? How do you see it, Carol?
There's a couple different things going on. You know, first, if you take the Saudi Arabia stop, that's obviously a very fraught relationship. It'll be the president's last visit to Saudi Arabia. It was his fourth time there.
More than any other president, I read here.
That's right. And so he went there with seeking a number of things. He wants a couple of things from the Saudis and the other Gulf states, including their help with ramping up the fight against Islamic State. And in particular, from the Saudis, he wants to try to get them to deal with Iran in a way that gets them, the two nations, towards what he has described as a cold peace.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, and he said they have to share the neighborhood.
Live with each other somehow.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All of which makes the Saudis just like, you know, scream and rip their hair out, because that's just not at all how they have see the region. It makes them feel that the president doesn't understand the threat from Iran, which is direct. They see just directly in their neighborhood. So there was a lot of patching up that the president needed to do. It's unclear that he accomplished that. I think the relationship is still very strained and will stay that way. But he needs Saudi Arabia and he needs the other Gulf states to achieve some of his main goals in the Middle East. And so he needed to make the stop there. And then if you go to his next stop in London, you know, he's there to try his basically to weigh in on another country's vote, which is something that he says he doesn't do typically, but I guess he's making an exception here. Mm-hmm. And that really matters in terms of how the U.S.'s relationship is going forward with the U.K. And then when he goes to Germany, you know, Angela Merkel is one of the leaders that the president likes the most. They have a very close working relationship. There are two of the only leaders that are still she's one of the only leaders that's still in office, that was in office when President Obama came in, a democratically elected leader. Mm-hmm. And she's in real trouble for the first time and since she's was elected over this refugee crisis. And so you'll see him try to buck her up a little bit, and he'll make a very public statement backing her on her position on and how she's handled the refugee crisis. So it's a lot of different things, and I think that what you'll see, and this trip is an example of that, for the rest of this year, is there's a lot of kind of, you know, trying to back clean up or just put these relationships and in a place that when he hands it over to his successor, they're on a trajectory that he thinks is positive.
Don't go for the Brexit, he asked the British people. Marjorie in Leon, Iowa. Marjorie, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling in regards to, I don't think that Obama should be trying to change their mind over there and the Queen's mind because...
On leaving the EU, you mean, Marjorie?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think he should be telling them to do that. I heard that also after I made up my mind. I heard it on the radio just a while ago, and the newspapers don't think they should either. And also, the Queen and a lot of the other people over there are talking about that they don't think it's a good idea. Many of them are grumbling about it.
Well, I mean, the Britons on both sides of that. I have to say the president was very respectful. I read the essay that he had in the Telegraph there. I mean, he wasn't browbeating them, but he said, look, the EU is good for everybody. It magnifies your influence, doesn't diminish it. But you're right. Many people don't agree. Jack, what do you think about him getting in the middle of this? We've got the London mayor, Boris Johnson, who, of course, is quite outspoken and often controversially. He said that suggested that President Obama may have an ancestral dislike of the British Empire because of his Kenyan roots, leading him, I guess, to get in on the Brexit debate. But I don't know. How do you see it, Jack? What the president's role of the United States when Britain thinks about the EU?
I think it's quite in line with our idea and their idea of the special relationship. He's speaking as a friend of the British people. And by the way, he's very popular there, especially among young people. Mm-hmm. So his voice counts. And he's saying that the main claim made by the Leave people, which, you know, this getting out of Europe would strengthen the transatlantic ties with the United States and we'd have a bilateral trade agreement with Britain that would make everything all right with pulling out of Europe. That's not on. Our trade people say we're not in the market for bilateral deals. That's an illusion. And the president is saying you're stronger, Britain, in the EU, and the Atlantic Alliance is stronger for them.
Lunch with the Queen on his way soon to Germany as well. Jack, stand by. Kara Lee with The Wall Street Journal. Olivier Knox at Yahoo News. We're looking at a week in the news. You can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, two huge earthquakes shook Ecuador. Here's the moment that the first quake struck. Deep and deadly flooding in Houston, Texas. Here's Harris County Sheriff Ron Hickman out on a rescue boat on Tuesday.
I've been out here almost 35 years and never seen water this high.
And anti-slavery icon Harriet Tubman will be the first African-American woman ever on U.S. currency on the front of the $20 bill. At her statue in Harlem, this woman and young boy celebrated the change.
It makes me proud as a black woman. It makes me very proud.
That's the first black person on the $20 bill.
Wow, just to hear that voice. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump and Clinton out front, Obama abroad, global warming at the U.N., criminal charges in Flint, Michigan, Harriet Tubman on the 20, Andrew Jackson on the back, and Prince has died. Kara Lee, White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, is here. Olivier Knox, Chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Jack Beatty's here. And Carl in Nashville is calling. Hi, Carl. You're on the air. Thank you for calling. Good to hear from you today.
Well, thank you very much. You know, normally I call in about politics, but I said, you know what? Prince is a little more important today than Donald Trump and his racist acts. So listen, two stories that really encapsulate what Prince is and what he meant to people. The first one was a story that took place in 1984. Prince had the genius to put two different songs not on the Purple Rain album. So you had to go out and buy these separately on 45.
Yeah.
I mean, I trudged through a snowstorm back home in Chicago to get Erotic City. You couldn't hear it on the radio because obviously Erotic City. And the only way you can get it is if you bought it, and it was very hard to find. So needless to say, the last store I went to, I found it.
Yep.
That was the business genius.
We've got the picture. You in the snow, and Prince put you there, trudging for Erotic City. What else, Carl?
Trudging for Erotic City. And the another story I heard from his first manager, the guy that pretty much discovered him, he said he was in his office. A guy walked in and said, I want you to listen to this demo. The guy put in the demo. He played it. The Prince first manager looked up and said, who is this band? And the guy said, no, you don't understand. This is one guy.
Right.
Who's doing all the music? This
one guy.
Did all the music, did all the vocals. He said, where is it? He said, well, he's just an 18-year-old kid. And he's like, what? That right there just encapsulated what Prince was. To try and nail him down as a musician, as an artist, as a producer, businessman.
Carl, can I ask you, Carl?
Among the best of all those things.
I hear it. I mean, can I ask you what he stood for to you? I know you. You're a big, strong, burly guy there in Nashville. And here's Prince with his act all over the place, bending every kind of line and musical line and cultural line, sexual, gender line. How did you look at all that? What did he mean?
You know what? At an early age, I figured it out. And a lot of people still haven't figured it out. Prince was this. Prince let you look behind the curtain of the entertainment business in his studio. You walk in that door, he may be sitting down eating a sandwich. He may be brushing his teeth. He may be in a pair of bikini underwear writing a song. But it was up to you to leave. See, he didn't care if you stayed in that room or not. You could have pulled up a chair and be entertained by all this, or you can get up and walk. But guess what? Even as you're walking out the door, and the door hitting you where the good Lord split you, Prince was still going to be doing what Prince was going to be doing in that room.
Carl,
you're welcome to come back whenever you want.
You're so great. You leave us with some great images. We got Prince in his bikini there, and you in the snow in Chicago for Erotic City. But you're right. It's a big deal culturally, and I really appreciate your coming in to testify on that front today, Carl. Thank you very much for your call. And Jack, I know that you booming Prince in your house all the time up there in the woods in New Hampshire. Maybe not, but still, this was a figure who just made people think about what we talk about in public, how we present ourselves, how we can get stuck in gender lanes, and maybe the world is a little more free than that, or could be, should be.
Yeah, the word I kept seeing was transcendent, that he transcended so many categories. We just heard from Carl some of them. Gender, race, in
sexuality,
the entertainment.
Right out
yes,
there. Yep.
Yes, yes, and did it with a happy affect and smile. So I'm just really struck by the outpouring of of really grief and warm memory about him.
It is really striking. Let me get one more call from Nashville. We've got a lot on the table this week. Virginia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to say, well, first of all, rest in peace to Prince. He was amazing. He's a legend. Secondly, I'm horrified that they're going to leave Andrew Jackson on the bill with Harriet Tubman. I just think it's kind of counterproductive.
Why? They're moving him to the back, so we're going to have people on both sides. We're going to have more things on other bills. But why are you horrified, Virginia?
Well, he was a slave owner, for one. And, you know, racism is still very much alive here in the South. And as it is all over the country, people don't realize that. I don't know if they're ignorant, but, you know, she was an amazing woman, went through a whole lot, and he put people through what she went through. So I think it's I just think it's wrong.
It's very interesting. You point out the slavery fighter on the front and the slaveholder on the back. I mean, that is American history, but here we are. And it's not the only bill that will change. You'll still have Abraham Lincoln on the five, but on the back of the five, you're going to have depictions of Martin Luther King Jr., Eleanor Roosevelt, black opera singer Marian Anderson, who, of course, famously sang on the Lincoln Memorial steps in 1939. And Carol Lee, what's your sense of how all this deliberation about what to do with these bills went down in the I guess this was Jack Lew's Treasury Department decision, but I wonder if the White House had a hand in there before it was all over as well?
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, they certainly had thoughts and opinions on it. It was a very interesting thing to watch because, you know, this had been rumored for some time, and this had been something that the president piqued the president's interest when this young girl had asked him why there wasn't a woman on any of her paper money. And so then it kind of went from there. And the $10 bill was obviously first, and so they looked at that. But then this Hamilton phenomenon, it just... And there was all this lobbying.
I mean, the new musical on Broadway, so popular, suddenly Alexander Hamilton's a hero again and can't take him off.
Right. And it was, you know, and here's this person who was barely known and everyone thought they could kind of boot him off or at least diminish his presence. They were trying to have it both ways in that they weren't going to completely replace him. He would still have a presence on there. But that just effort, you know, got derailed. And then, you know, I think there was some in the White House who felt that Andrew Jackson was a better option because of what your caller just mentioned, that history. And so there was a lot of discussion and debate, but it's been very interesting. I mean, people have been really interested in this, and it strikes a chord, and I think from the White House's perspective, and particularly this president, you know, he's going to leave office with having put in place some pretty significant changes in terms of culturally, at least on the money that we all use every day.
We have complicated history, and it's not all pretty. Everybody deserves representation in it. I think you can make that case. John in Newport, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. It's good to speak to you.
You too.
I feel it's a mistake to change the bills. I like them the way they are, and I'll never accept a 20 and change or a 5 if they do that.
John, are you just being stodgy? What? Why? Why, John?
Andrew Jackson was the hero of New Orleans, and this woman committed crimes while she was alive. It was a crime to do what she was doing.
Oh, come on. Are you really going to say that someone who fought slavery was in the wrong? I mean, really?
It was a crime.
Well, please. Please. I mean...
Well, it was a crime to do that. That's
okay.
The underground.
But you know what, John? When some immoral thing is legal, there is a standard by which right-thinking people stand up and fight it.
Yep, but it was the law. She didn't obey the law.
Oh my goodness!
Jackson was a hero. He was a great man.
John, I'm gonna carpet the floor in 20s and see how long it takes you. But I appreciate your call very much. I really do. I mean, you know, Jack, here's this complicated history of ours, and it just stares us right in the face every time. I don't know many who would criticize Harriet Tubman for her amazing struggle against slavery. But even there, everybody's got an opinion in this country. Everybody. Keep your 20. Keep the change.
You know, there's a quote from her. She said, I was a conductor of the Underground Railroad for 8 years, and I can say what most conductors can't say. I never ran my train off the track, and I never lost a passenger. Quite a claim.
Yeah, that is pretty good. Can we just peek back toward Iraq for a second here. This week, the news that we're going to put 200 more troops on the ground and 8 Apache helicopters, and not at the rear, but closer to the front, closer to the action. And we're told by Ash Carter, the defense secretary who's out there, that this is in preparation for going after Mosul, which ISIS, of course, took, and it was promised it would be retaken, but has not been. Olivier, what about where this puts American troops and this convergence? We've had Kerry out there, Obama out there, Ash Carter out there. Are we changing gears again somehow in our posture in the Middle East?
This is the really important backdrop to the president's visit to the Middle East, I think. There is definitely an escalation of the U.S. mission against the Islamic State. You might even call it mission creep. You're seeing an expansion of the ground troop presence, the air presence. We started using B-52s now in the air campaign. The Pentagon is changing the combat role of American troops. I should say at one point they said that American troops are not in combat. They're in combat situations, which is a little bit like saying that Prince isn't dead. He's in a death situation.
Yeah.
But so you're seeing this really this escalation of the American campaign, which whatever else you think about it, is extremely notable and extremely important. And to one of Carol's points earlier, this is also a big part of looking ahead and seeing what kind of world Obama's successor, is going to inherit.
Carol, are we going to see this president go out of office in a blaze of Apache helicopter fire in Iraq again?
Well, you're certainly going to see this president go out of office with Iraq looking very different from how he hoped it would look when he entered office in 2009. And you can say the same about Afghanistan, where he will leave at least more than 5,000 troops there, potentially closer to 10,000, depending on the decision he makes later this year. Mosul's obviously – the White House has two goals in terms of ramping up the fight against Islamic State, or I should say like two areas where they really feel like they need to attack it, and that is Mosul and that's Raqqa in Syria. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they couldn't launch the mission against Mosul if they didn't ramp this up. And they're going to likely wind up having to do the same in Syria. To go to Olivier's point earlier, this is a really dramatic shift. If you look at the arc of where we began here in August of 2014 with the president announcing some very limited strikes to help some Christian minorities who were under siege in Iraq, you know, now we're in a very different place. And, you know, you're frankly going to see more than this. But at the same time, you have a president who has ruled out a large-scale ground invasion anywhere in the Middle East. And he's not going to do that in Iraq, and he's not going to do that in Syria. And so he's continuing to, as the White House puts it, you know, crank up different elements of his current strategy, which is not satisfying anyone who's calling on him to do a lot more. And then to others, you know, it looks like he's doing too much.
A tough balancing act right there. I have to say, we're looking at a week in the news. Sorry, Carol. Not easy, but he doesn't want to leave either ISIS fully formed there or American troops in the middle of big combat.
That's right. And so you're going to see him try to strike this middle balance for the rest of his 9 months in office. And this is one of the many things that's going to get handed off to the next president. And he or she may decide to do something different. But you're not going to see this president make any really dramatic changes in his strategy.
Olivier, we've got these criminal charges in Flint, Michigan this week. Three sort of water service employees there are now facing actual criminal charges. Did everybody see that coming? Are we going to – how far up the chain in Michigan does that go? I don't know how closely you're watching that from Washington, but it's striking to see criminal charges now in that lead poisoning case, the whole town wrestling with in Flint.
Well, the whole story is just appalling. I mean, the idea that government officials would allegedly alter testing result documents to suggest that lead lowers in water were lower than they actually were, or that Maryland State environmental quality officials would mislead the Environmental Protection Agency, again, allegedly, about whether or not they had the proper corrosion control.
Yep.
This is just it's a horrifying story. And the question of how far up it goes, you know, we are watching this in Washington in part because Congress and the president and EPA have all trained their focus on this. It's horrifying. I don't know how far up it goes. Democrats have been training their fire on the governor, Snyder.
Governor,
but,
there.
It, it's not really clear yet exactly what role his administration played. But one of the things about criminal charges is that there are really few better ways to leverage cooperative testimony than to charge somebody with felonies, with a felony. So this is going to be a really interesting and important story, especially because it may apply to other states. You know, we may find out that Flint is not just a one-off, that in fact we have this problem in a lot of other areas.
Hello, people. Watch out. Keep your water safe and clean. Don't turn a blind eye. And certainly don't fake the results. If you've got lead problems, let's talk about it. We're just about out of time there. We've got still calls coming in on Prince. Greg in Michigan and Ontonagon, Michigan says, Prince, 10 times better than Michael Jackson. We'll save that standoff for another day. But we remember Prince and all of his work this week. Dead at 57. That's a shocker. Carol Lee, White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for being with us today. Wonderful to have you here, Carol.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Olivier Knox, Chief Washington Correspondent for Yahoo News. Olivier, thanks very much for coming in.
Never give up, never surrender, Tom.
Okay, Galaxy Quest. Jack Beatty, stay on that quest, sir. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thank you.
A Little Prince, Let's Go Crazy, 1984 from Purple Rain. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Don't lie. Where's your living here? Take a look around. At least you got friends. I call my old lady. Oh, friendly word. She picked up the phone, dropped it on the floor. That's all I heard. I'm gonna let the elevator break us down. Oh no, let's go crazy. Let's get nuts. Slip for the purple.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.